Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, I'm just sitting here on my back deck, enjoying a nice cool evening. The heat of the day is gone, and some of my neighbors are driving home. You might be hearing them on the gravel roads around here. So how are you doing this season? In the last week of June and the first week of July, I was enjoying travels to and from the Olympic Peninsula and hanging out with family there. It was great. The coast was very cool compared to areas more close to home. And I got my introduction to both Mount Rainier and the Northern Cascades National Forest. It was a wonderful trip, and as we drove south to come home down Highway 200, the temperatures rose and the air started getting hazy with smoke. We are definitely in fire season here in Montana, so stay safe, be careful with any campfires, and get your go bag ready. This week, our episode is titled, This is Border Radio. It was July 24th, 2020, when this episode first aired on Desert Oracle Radio, and the Rona was still spreading like wildfire, so scheduled shows sometimes got a little jumbled. Anyway, in this one, Ken talks about his dad, exploitive corporations, and then takes a nice detour about local music. By the way, KGVM does an excellent job spotlighting local artists. I hope you know that already. Well, here goes.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. I was driving through Anzabrego, down the Salton Seaway, Ocotillo. Nothing fun. Some family business, just taking the scenic route back. My occasional reminder why I've landed up here in the high desert. Far from that grim border scene that just keeps growing upward and outward, a cancer by choice year after year, long before the current outrages, that militarized hell zone. Now, my dad, who has been gone a long time now, more than a quarter century, well, he used to have some wild stories. He grew up on the south side of Phoenix with his twin brother and their dad, who was a union steward at the Goodyear factory west of town. And that's a suburb called Goodyear now, full of those enormous tract house boxes on a little sliver of gravel and concrete. They had come from a little coal company town called Wayland in eastern Kentucky, named after the coal company boss. How'd you like that, to live and die in a place named for your boss? You ever hear that song 16 Tons about wage labor coal miners who owe their life to the company store? The coal company did not just own your place of work, your employment, and all the mountain land they destroyed and polluted all around you, and your crappy little shack on the highway where the coal trucks and coal trains rumbled by all day and night. but they own the only store in town, too. And because it was starvation labor, the workers never had enough to buy food, shoes for their kids, all that 100% true Loretta Lynn stuff. So you do what's now called a payday loan, the same scam writ large. You would go into debt at the coal companies, especially grim version of a Dollar General. If you can imagine something more grim than a Dollar General, they owned you. They owned your life. They owned where you slept, what you eat. Now, my dad was just a little kid when he left there, but he hated it so much he never had any interest in going back. One time we went to visit his mother in West Virginia for Christmas, and he drove the Tennessee-Virginia route, absolutely no interest in driving through eastern Kentucky, ever seeing it again. And he never did. Once he and his twin brother were old enough to drive and clever enough to hotwire a car, around 12 or 13 or so, I think, they ran wild in Arizona. A very different Phoenix than what we know today of his Marty Robbins playing Mexican and Native-inspired hillbilly boogie at a gas station that functioned as a drive-in bar on weekends. Marty would be up on a flatbed with the other musicians. 1950s on the south side of the tracks, the wrong side. My dad and his twin, they liked motorcycles. They had those Wild Bunch choppers all stripped down, and the cops would always pull them over for not having rear view mirrors. Give them tickets, threaten their lives, the usual thing cops do to poor people. So being smart, Alex, the Lane brothers got some little dental mirrors from the medical supply store, tiny round chrome mirrors. And apparently the cops were baffled and furious about this clever little trick. Technically, the mirrors met the vehicular code. It was like that Robert Mitchum movie, Thunder Road, minus the moonshine. Although they probably did bring a lot of contraband back from Nogales, crosstops and the like. Maybe they ran bootleg tequila, who knows. From the stories I heard, they spent maybe every other weekend carousing in Nogales. Border crossing was a more casual affair back then. At some point, although nobody ever gave me the straight story on this, and I guess I'll never get any straight answers on this or another 100 topics, the choice was the military or juvie. That seems to be what happened for both of them. So one enlisted in the Air Force, one in the Navy. That's how most people end up enlisting. Blackmail of one sort or another. Oh sure, the waterheads on the New York Times op-ed page are full of pro-military fascist glory. From their mansions in Arlington and Chevy Chase and Foggy Bottom. But for the people they dump in the hot zone, it's almost always blackmail. Economic blackmail, primarily. Now, a bunch of guys on the base tonight are nodding along. They know the score. Keep your head down and try to get out alive. Try to get out with that piece of paper that'll let you maybe get a decent job somewhere. Maybe something with health insurance so you don't have to drag your carcass to the line outside at the VA hospital. Get in there and fight with the rats. If you want to be a military character, just be honest about it, like that George Washington. He just wanted real estate and he did not mind killing for it. So he volunteered to survey the land of the Indian nations on the eastern seaboard and inland, murdered as many Native Americans as he could, and then sold their land to other Tory gentry in Virginia. Then when his band of rich people rebelled against the mother country over taxes, of course, they stuffed Washington back into his Indian massacre uniform with his gut hanging out and the buttons popping off and his mouth clenched tight. Around the transplanted teeth he'd had ripped out of the mouths of the human beings he kept in bondage as his slaves. You didn't really believe that wooden teeth story, did you? And well, he was the most useless general you could get. He was good at beating and flogging the starving forced enlistment soldiers of the Continental Army and not too good at anything else. If it wasn't for the European War raging between an ascendant France and a struggling England, well, who knows? Maybe we'd all have healthcare today. And maybe slavery would have ended, truly ended, 50 years earlier than it sort of halfway not really did after the victorious American War against the South. Anyway, crossing the border was a more casual affair in the 1950s. As it was even in my lifetime, if you lived on the U.S. side of Tecate or Tijuana in the 1980s, you had favorite restaurants and bars and artisan shops that you went back to time and again. Now, way back then, I lived kind of halfway in the backcountry near Tecate, so we'd dress up and go to Tecate on Saturday night to dine in style at one of the famous Chinese restaurants there. Still a bunch there. Whatever Chinese cuisine you like, they probably got a place that specializes in it. And because it was Mexico, the food was so good and spicy as hell, all kinds of stuff you never saw in the American restaurants then, especially in San Diego. At one point in the late 80s, I knew all these artists and journalists who lived in the cheap and fun and intellectually stimulating artist neighborhoods in the easy parts of TJ. I knew them mostly through my wife at the time, who covered the border art scene for the college newspaper and the LA Times, and knew this group from her art classes at SDSU, where I managed to have a late night radio show without ever enrolling in the college, which seemed like a waste of time. We'd have these wonderful nights every now and then, walking across the border from the trolley station and meeting up at some art gallery or concert space with all this heavy cultural stuff, and then you're at a neighborhood working class bar or restaurant, walking narrow streets, drinking and singing and laughing, music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Guillermo Gomez Pena was one of the artists. Fernando Romero was one of the journalists running the Union Tribune Tijuana Bureau. And he was a jazz drummer, too. Had worked the strip clubs on Revolucion from the time he was just a kid. Gomez Pena did these wild performances wearing a Mexican wrestling mask, all very controversial, in San Diego, which was and still is his Nixon's suburb, ironically dropped on the Mexican border. He had very dramatically been married to U.S. artist Emily Hicks just off the shore of the international border, where the border fence went right into the surf like some Cristo installation. They divorced a year later, but what an art project.
Unable to deliver, unable to understand the deliverer.
Give me a name and rank real quick.
Hey there, this is Jason Woodbury. My rank, I don't know. I'm some sort of field marshal. I don't know.
That's right.
Roving correspondent.
Welcome back to Desert Oracle Radio. It's time for a segment that we started late last year with our friend Jason P. Woodbury in Phoenix, Arizona, from Aquarium Drunkard and Zia Records. is called The Woodbury Files. It's where we talk about the musical culture of the Desert Southwest. Jason, welcome back to Desert Oracle Radio.
Hey, Ken. It's always great to be here.
Now, we talked a little while ago about our subject tonight, and let's just dive right in, because when you say the name, people generally think of the desert.
Well, the name is Giant Sand. We're going to talk about one of, I think, the strangest bands that the desert has ever produced. You know, out here in Arizona, Ken, I guess there's some sort of perceived rivalry between Phoenix and Tucson. You hear about it sometimes, but I guess in that case, I'm going to cross the battle lines today to talk about, I think, one of the best groups that Arizona's ever produced, Tucson's own Giant Sand. They're one of the most vexing and sort of strangely beautiful, too. You're a deep music head, and you spent a lot of years playing music. I'm curious, when did you first hear Giant Sand, Ken?
I first heard Giant Sand in the very early 90s, and I first saw them and met the group in Prague in 1992, early 1992, okay. I believe.
Yeah.
At a place called Club Bunker, and I worked at the radio station there, Radio Jedna, the alternative station there in Prague, and they came in and they filled the joint, and everybody knew all about them. And here I was, somebody who had even lived in Arizona myself and was from this area. And they were way ahead of me. I just knew a little bit about them, and they blew me away that night.
Like a lot of Arizona, or sorry, rather, let me rephrase, like a lot of American acts, they're pretty fervently revered, you know, overseas versus, not to say that they don't do very good in Tucson, they do. Over there, there's a real appreciation for the kind of mix of American culture that a group like Giant Sand represents. You know, this, I think, was a listener request. Somebody had suggested that we dig into Giant Sand, so I'm really glad to be able to do so. I think I first heard them through a group that sort of spun out of Giant Sand, the band Calexico, which was a favorite of mine, and I started kind of going back, and that's the wild thing about Giant Sand, is that all these groups have been in, you know, all these people in the band, it's an ever-evolving collective. And over the last couple decades, there have been members of Dream Syndicate, Green on Red, members of the Go-Go's. But the guy who's at the center of Giant Sand is Hal Gelb, you know, whose whole thing is this skewed, strange, desert-warped sensibility that really nobody else has a sound like him. He's got a very distinct voice, this kind of low rumble, and this sound that sort of refuses to ever solidify into just one thing. So you've got sort of Neil Young and Crazy Horse style rock, and then you've got Paisley Underground, psychedelia, and then country, jazz, spaghetti western soundscapes. They're really one of the strangest and most exciting groups ever to come out of the desert.
Yeah, and they play the kind of stuff that you can enjoy late at night by yourself, stony, country, twangy, heartbroken stuff, driving down a desert highway. I mean, it's soundtrack stuff, you know? It's like whatever you're doing, it's made more beautiful and more cinematic by having Giant Sand on.
Hanging by a thread, well out on the rope. Well, you got enough to hang ya, but you know better to stand still.
Yeah, they've got a fascinating history too. So the group was formed in Tucson. Originally, the name was Giant Sandworms, and they were named after the, speaking of the desert, of course, the spice producing giant worms from Frank Herbert's space opera Dune. Hal Gelb started Giant Sandworms after a particularly adventurous acid experience. I asked him about this once. The beauty of being here in Arizona and occasionally getting down to Tucson. The beauty of that is that Howe is around all the time, and he's always been willing to let me pester him about the band and its history and its sound. Talking with him is just wild. They actually got started pretty much right as punk was kicking off. The early stuff is very, very punk, but what happened was in the late 70s, when Gelb was, as he put it, prone to psychedelic experiences, he dropped a ton of acid and ended up staying up for 3 days. And at the end of these 3 days, he went to go see Roman Polanski's The Tenant at a little art house theater in Tucson called The Loft. The Loft is still around. You can go watch a movie there. Well, I think you can watch one online right now, but once this is all done, you'll be able to go back. I saw Repo Man there a few years ago. It's one of the all-time great desert art house theaters. He watched this Polanski movie and it kind of sent his head reeling. So he wandered over to the Helen Street Cafe, which was this little place he hung out. And there was a guitarist on stage, this guy named Reiner, who would go on to his own career, but also was this guy that Howe formed Giant Sandworms with. And there was a piano on stage, and Reiner's up there playing guitar, this kind of slide guitar, steel. He had a bunch of famous fans. You might remember that compilation that they put out in the 90s that featured Robert Plant and ZZ Top. Reiner's up on stage, and Howe gets up on stage coming off of this acid trip and starts playing with them on the piano. And he wasn't very good at piano, but he could muddle around in the key of G. So they did that for a few hours. By the end of that, Howe had decided that Giant Sand was a thing. They kind of started working and they did an EP, and eventually they dropped the Worms from the name, so it just became Giant Sand. And they put out their first record called Valley of Rain, which has this strange, like you said, eerie desert nighttime quality to it, but then it's also got a lot of real punk energy. So that was how things started. And in the years that have gone on since, the lineup has shifted and morphed, and it's featured people from all over the world. This record that a lot of people got on board with, and I don't know if this is around when you got on board, but in the early 90s, they signed to a major label, Imago Records. They put out a record called Glum, which is a really, really good album.
Right, that was like their grunge era hit, right?
Yeah, that was the time where everybody at all the major labels decided, oh, we got to start signing these punk bands, these underground bands.
Sure.
Maybe we'll get another Nirvana.
We need some Meat Puppets, and we need some Giant Sand, and some Dinosaur Jr.
Yeah, who didn't get signed? I mean, the Butthole Surfers got signed to a major label contract. Just about everybody who had been kicking around in this weird American DIY independent punk thing got signed. So Glum is a great record. I really, really enjoy that one. And their 90s records are great. But for me, I really get into it in the early 2000s after they signed a Thrill Jockey. And like I said, the Calexico thing, Joey Burns and John Convertino were these two guys who got their start in Giant Sand. And that's actually one of the most interesting things about Giant Sand, is that the players who got their start there and then went off to go do their own thing is insane as well. You got these guys, there's a great band down in Tucson called Zika, and there's a drummer, Winston Wallace, who played with Patti Smith and Bob Dylan. So there's all these people who kind of get their start in Giant Sand. It's like an incubator for weird, eccentric talent. But in the 2000s, they put out my favorite record of theirs called Chore of Enchantment. In addition to having a great desert name, was produced by PJ Harvey associate John Parrish and Jim Dickinson from Memphis, one of the all-time great American record producers.
Sure.
who must have saw in Howe Gelb the same wild streak that he saw in people like Alex Shilton or Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Tab Falco, The Replacements. So that's the thing about Giant Sand, is that they have a real connection to that side of things, the American rock underground. But then they've got this strange spaciness that you alluded to that just really cements things. And that carries over through all of Howe's stuff. He's got solo records. He's got side projects like Arizona Amp and Alternator and the Band of Blackie Ranchette. at one point, he in about 2012, he decided that giant sand had outgrown itself and that it needed to become giant sand. So Hal added an extra giant to the name, and they released a record at this point with a bunch of great people. Phoenix vocalist named Lana Kelly, whose work is great. She's in a great indie dream pop band called Cherie Cherie. I advise everybody to go check out her stuff. But they put out this thing in 2012 called Tucson, a country rock opera, which was sort of centered on the idea of being in Tucson and sort of escaping the place that you come from, but then being drawn back. So there's all these hilarious lyric, you know, good luck suckers is like sort of a phrase that carries all through the record. But it's just that same weird, wild, diverse set of things happening on the record, where it rocks one second and then it's spooky the next, and then it's kind of drifting and melodic. In 2016, though, he decided that Giant Sand was done. In being how, with this strange sensibility, he decided he would announce it by saying that I kind of quit, I think is what he put it. You know, I think I kind of quit. I guess he couldn't stay away, because the band came right back to life in 2018. And they released their most recent record, which brings us full circle. It's called Returns to Valley of Rain. And it was Hal and all of his awesome musicians just completely reimagining the first record, Valley of Rain. And it's as punk and noisy and loud as anything he's ever done. So the thing about him is that he's just this man of extremes. And I think that's something that maybe feels very uniquely Arizonan. But Hal is a strange dude. He's prone to speaking in riddles. And Giant Sand is, to my mind, one of the most exciting things that the desert rock scenes, you know, ever produce.
Amboy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. I'm your host, Ken Lane. Some sounds tonight from our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver, plus some of Giant Sand. Check them out on Spotify or whatever, maybe buy a real record. Our theme song, this one I'm talking over, is by Pierre Langer. We broadcast from Joshua Tree on Friday nights locally from KCDZ 107.7 FM, streaming on the internet if you're out of range, or better yet, get yourself in range. Get a home on the range. Be a holy ranger. You can get the Desert Oracle podcast through all the usual outlets. We got 100 episodes now. We got a Patreon set up as well. It's how we pay the bills, and we're lucky to have a way. Lucky to have all of you. Join the few and the proud on patreon.com, Desert Oracle, or just check out our website at desertoracle.com. We are not taking a summer break this year, as should be obvious from the fact that we just keep on ticking over here in the Desert Oracle Radio Studio, but I promised myself that after episode number 100... I would give myself a two-week break, not for vacation, not quite yet, but to finish the new Desert Oracle periodical, the pocket-sized newspaper of the Desert Southwest, making some changes, and the biggest change is we're trying to get back on the quarterly schedule. So if your subscription lapsed, now's a good time to re-up, as they say, before I send the subscriber list to the printer in about a week, so they can ship those suckers out. Hang in there these next 2 weeks. Let me get my green eye shade on my head, get over to the editing desk, and wrap up this issue. Because we were born upside down, born the wrong way around, this is episode number 99, and the 100th episode was last week, but it'll all work out. We do appreciate you making the time to spend with us. on Friday nights or whenever you listen. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Well, we are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. The birds at my house have been enjoying the long, warm days, and I am enjoying the cool mornings and twilight when the Swainson's thrushes are singing. But some birds are looking a bit ragged in the feathers. Have you seen this? Here's a bird note about just that subject. It's called Flying and Molting, a Tricky Balance.
This is Bird Note. Feathers are miraculous structures, especially the long, strong feathers of a bird's wings and tail that make flight itself possible. But after about a year, constant use and exposure to the elements mean they have to be replaced. So, how do you replace the roughly 20 feathers in each wing that are essential to flight without becoming earthbound? Many birds molt a few flight feathers at a time, wait until new ones grow in, molt another few, and so on. Usually the same feathers on each wing at the same time, symmetrically. So in summer, a raven that's molting might look a little ragged in the same part of each wing. For ravens, a molt can take up to 6 months. For smaller birds, closer to 2. But, crucially, they can still fly. Water birds like ducks and loons, though, are too heavy to fly with even a few feathers missing. So they molt all their flight feathers at once, becoming earthbound and especially vulnerable to predators for a month or more. During this time, they stay in or very close to the water and out of harm's way until their full suite of feathers has been completely restored. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, the day of this broadcast, July 21st, 2024, we have a full moon. Science.nasa.gov has this to say. The next full moon is the Buck or Thunder Moon, the Hay or Mead Moon, Guru Purnima, Asala Puja, also known as Dharma Day, or Isala Poya, and the start of Vasa. Okay, I'm going to make a quick note right here. Nothing on that website tells me how to pronounce those names, so I do apologize if I am saying things terribly wrong. anyway, here we go. The next full moon will be Sunday morning, July 21st, 2024, appearing opposite the sun in Earth-based longitude at 6:17 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. For the International Dateline West and the American Samoa and Midway time zones, this will be late Saturday night. For Line Islands time, this will be early Monday morning. The moon will appear full for about 3 days around this time, from Friday evening through Monday morning, making this a full moon weekend. The Maine Farmer's Almanac began publishing Indian names for full moons in the 1930s, and these names are now widely known and used. According to this almanac, as the full moon in June, the Algonquin tribes of what is now the northeastern United States called this the Buck Moon. Early summer is normally when the new antlers of buck deer push out of their foreheads in coatings of velvety fur. They also called this the Thunder Moon because of early summer's frequent thunderstorms. Europeans called this the Hay Moon for the haymaking of early summer, and sometimes the Mead Moon although the name was also used for the previous full moon. Mead is created by fermenting honey mixed with water, sometimes adding fruits, spices, grains, or hops. For Hindus, Buddhists, and Jains, this is the Guru full moon, Guru Purnima, celebrated as a time for clearing the mind and honoring the guru or spiritual master. For Theravada Buddhists, this full moon is Asaha Puja, also known as Dharma Day or Isala Puja, an important festival celebrating the Buddha's first sermon after reaching Nirvana, which started Buddhism. This sermon became the core of Buddhist teachings and includes the Four Noble Truths. In addition, with this full moon, the Buddhist monks start Vassa, the annual three-month retreat during the rainy season. Whew. Okay, here's my little note. We could use some rain here, right? Okay, anyway. In many traditional lunisolar and lunar calendars, full moons fall on or near the middle of the lunar months. This full moon is near the middle of the sixth month of the Chinese year of the dragon, Tammuz in the Hebrew calendar, and Muharram in the Islamic calendar. Muharram is one of the four sacred months during which warfare is forbidden. Since this is the thunder moon, a quick note on lightning safety. Most of the lightning that strikes the ground arcs from the negatively charged bottom of the storm to the ground underneath the storm. Much rarer is positive lightning, which arcs from the top of a thunderstorm to strike much farther away. Positive lightning can sometimes strike areas where the sky is clear, hence the term bolt out of the blue. NOAA's Lightning FAQ page says that almost all lightning will occur within 10 miles of its parent thunderstorm, but that lightning detection equipment has confirmed bolts striking up to almost 50 miles away. Because positive lightning arcs across a greater distance, it tends to be 5 to 10 times more powerful than regular ground strikes. It can strike dry areas outside of the storm's rainfall, so positive lightning tends to start more fires than negative lightning. Although positive lightning is rare, less than 5% of all lightning strikes, the lack of warning and its greater power make it more lethal. A good rule to follow is, if you can hear the thunder, you can be struck by lightning. As a bicycle enthusiast and daily commuter before I retired, I am well aware that the inch or so of rubber tire between my metal bicycle and the ground will make little difference to a bolt that can arc across miles of air from the top of a thunderstorm to where I am riding. As usual, the wearing of suitably celebratory celestial attire is encouraged in honor of the full moon. Be safe, especially during thunderstorms. Avoid starting wars, and take a moment to clear your mind.
Asaha Puja.
Asanha Puja.
Well, on these summer nights, when the full moon is not overpowering the sky, the Milky Way overhead is just as dazzling. In my recent journeys, I traveled across the lands of many indigenous peoples. The Blackfeet are people whose ancestral lands probably include where you are right now if you are listening in the Gallatin Valley. I want to include a story from Carl Brave Rock about how his people think about the Milky Way, which they also know as the Wolf Trail.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a story called Makoyoksakoi, the Wolf Trail. The Wolf Trail is what people call today the Milky Way Galaxy. And our people believe that that's where we came from. And that's our gateway to the sky to see Natusi Ki, Kokumi Kisun, the sun and the moon, the grandfather and the grandmother. The story of Scarface speaks of Makoyoksakoi. But I'm going to give you a story today of how we got the Wolf Trail. So a long time ago, the people, they were starving. This is before the people knew how to hunt. It was one particularly harsh winter where the people could not find any food at all. They knew they were going to die. But one young man, he didn't want to die. He decided that he was going to go out on his own and he wasn't going to come back without food. Now the people knew that this was a suicide mission. It was the middle of winter and he was going out on his own. He wasn't going to come back without any food. So the boy went out, the guy went out, the young man, and he set up camp. And I've been told that the wolves were the first animals to pity us humans. They saw what this young man was doing. And they went to his camp and they brought him some meat, some food. And the wolves told him, Makoi, told him, bring this food back to your people. Feed your people and come back. So he did that. He went back to his people. He brought them food. And he told the elders what had happened. So the elders told him, well, you have to listen. You have to go back now. So he went back to his lone camp. And sure enough, the wolves came again. Makoi, the wolf. They came. And he said, well, now we're going to take you to our camp. So they took him back to their camp. And at their camp, they told him how to hunt. They taught him how to hunt communally. And they taught him how, they told him to show his people how to hunt as a community. And that's how we got stuff like the buffalo jump, where everyone had an intricate role. If anyone failed, the entire buffalo jump would fail. So we had to work as a community. And the wolves, that's what they taught him. As well, other animals began to show up at this camp, and they taught him different hunting rules. Like one rule is paws and claws are bad, hooves and horns are good. Just to sum that up, that's what we hunt on prayer. We don't eat big cats, but we will go after elk and deer. Those are good food. So those are some rules that were taught to the young man. Now, when the young man came back, he taught his people what the wolves had taught him, to hunt communally. The wolves stayed for the season, but come spring they said they had to go. The people were very sad, they didn't want to see the wolves go. But the wolves said, we're going to go somewhere where you're going to see us anytime you want. And they went to the sky, and they created what we call Makoyoksakoi, the Wolf Trail, what people call the Milky Way Galaxy. That's your story now. Yeah.
Well, did you listen last week? We talked a little bit about the mystery beast at the Madison Valley History Museum in Ennis. I haven't gotten over there yet, but I found an interesting little item in Awesome Possum, Volume 3, about cryptozoology. Patricia Maldonado writes, what is cryptozoology? From the Greek word crypto, meaning to hide, cryptozoology is a study of cryptids, hidden animals not accepted or recognized by mainstream science. Creatures like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster are popularly categorized as cryptids, but actually belong in the category of paracryptozoology, which deals with beasts possessing otherworldly or supernatural abilities. Cryptozoology has developed a stigma amongst scientists and zoologists because of eccentrics, hoaxes, and monster hunting shows in pop culture. It is currently viewed as a pseudoscience, about as reputable as astrology. Cryptozoology is just one of many paths to zoological discovery. It steps in where traditional scientific methods may have blind spots. There are countless species of undiscovered animals in places like secluded jungles or deep underwater, but a great deal of zoological discovery happens through random accidental collection or organized surveys where the research does not specifically target a potential unknown species. Many species remain hidden because they possess a physical characteristic that makes chance discovery improbable, or they inhabit remote locations that limit their encounters with humans. One example is the giant squid. Their deep-sea habitat makes study difficult. In 2004, scientists with Japan's National Science Museum captured the first footage of a live giant squid in its natural habitat. Before this, all research on this elusive creature was conducted on corpses that washed on shore. Cryptozoology focuses on ethno-known species, undiscovered animals that might have had some prior contact with humans. These might be folkloric animals from a people's belief system or those mentioned in an explorer's journal. Cryptozoologists analyze these reported sightings, determine which mystery animals might be real unknown biological species, and develop a methodology for obtaining concrete physical evidence of their existence. Here are some examples. Kim Quy, the golden turtle god of Vietnamese legend, is known today as the Hoan Kim turtle, and the Egyptian god Set is most commonly represented by the Sha, an unknown animal depicted with large triangular ears, which resemble those of a fennec fox. And the Aztec Ahuizote, a carnivorous aquatic monster, is speculated to have been a type of river otter. Cryptids are divided into four main categories: animals similar to known species but with obvious phenotypic differences. The Marozi is believed to be a distinct race of lion with a spotted coat adapted for forests rather than the savanna. Animals similar to a known species but outside a normally accepted geographic range is another category of cryptids. In 2006, 125,000 lowland gorillas were discovered in a swamp in the Northern Republic of Congo. Scientists acted on a tip by hunters and traveled 80 kilometers off the main road to find double the number of the endangered gorillas previously thought to survive worldwide. The third category of cryptids is animals that appear unrelated to any known or extinct species. And an example is the okapi, were first described in 1887 in the journal of explorer Henry Morton Stanley. Its unusual description caused many to doubt the animal's existence until a specimen was sent to London in 1901. And finally, the fourth category of cryptids is animals similar to a known extinct species. The thylacine, commonly known as the Tasmanian tiger, is one example. It was hunted to extinction in the wild in 1930, with the last known member of the species dying in captivity in 1936. In the 80 years since the species became extinct, there have been thousands of unconfirmed sightings. Cryptozoology has a strong focus on conservationism. Animal extinction happens naturally, and it is estimated that we lose 1 to 5 species a year Deforestation, or the introduction of invasive species to an environment, has multiplied the natural rate of extinction. It is estimated we are now losing dozens of species a day due to human actions. Countless species go extinct before they are discovered, and many cryptozoologists hope that inspiring interest in the discovery of new animals will also inspire a greater interest in conservation efforts. In order to protect both undiscovered and endangered animals, we must first protect our environment. And then they list a few species. The Pyrenean ibex is extinct. The Macaya breast spot frog is critically endangered. And the Javan tiger is extinct. So when I finally do get to go see that beast and get back here to talk about it, I hope you'll keep all that in mind. Well, the Awesome Possum series is edited by Angela Boyle, and volumes 1, 2, and 3 can be purchased from most of your favorite booksellers. Finally, we have a few local opportunities coming up that might be fun. Well, first off, I have some opportunities from the Summer Field Trip Guide from Montana Native Plant Society. And if you want more information about these hikes, you can contact the people I mention when I read to you about it, or go to mtnativeplants.org. And I'm sure they have some contact information there that you can ask them about these events and to ask them about other events coming up. But for now, I'm going to give you enough notice so that you can actually get registered for these, because usually pre-registration is required. And on these two, that's a definite yes. The first one is Tuesday, July 30th, Dry Creek Ridge Hike, that's near Livingston. So this hike is 5 miles, strenuous. Dry Ridge is among the best places to view wildflowers in the Gallatins. Join us for a hike up West Pine Creek Trail, where we'll travel through a burn-scarred forest before eventually reaching the open grassland ridge. Once atop these mountain meadows, we'll search for bitterroot, paskflower, arrowleaf balsam root, lupine, and whatever flowers we find in bloom. Views of the Paradise Valley and the Absarokas will give us reason to pick our heads up occasionally. Hosted by Wild Montana, pre-registration is required. Sign-ups begin 1 month before the outing at wildmontana.org/walks. And then in August, on Thursday, August 1st, Ruby Habitat Foundation, Working Lands and Conservation, and this is near Alder. So this is 1.5 miles, and it's easy. You explore the nature path at the Ruby Habitat Foundation's nonprofit Working Ranch, dedicated to preserving and enhancing the natural resources and social and economic makeup of the Ruby Valley. Enjoy some time for nature journaling or field sketching, and hear about fifth-generation Ruby Valley rancher Les Gilman and Wild Montana Conservation Director Emily Cleveland about the role of working lands in conservation and wildlife connectivity. The hike will last 2 hours and includes visiting the Ruby Habitat Foundation's lovely pollinator garden. Following the hike at 5:30 p.m., join the Wildlife Speaker Series, a free and informative presentation on the mountain lion research of Joshua Lisbon, Education Director of MPG Ranch. Pre-registration is required, and it's hosted by Wild Montana. Sign-ups begin 1 month before the outing at wildmontana.org. That's all one word, wildmontana.org /walks. So with those two, you're registering at the same place. And then random acts of silliness, you can contact them at hello@randomactsofsilliness.com. They are going to be in the Sweet Pea Parade, evidently. And I think they have spots for just a few more marchers. No musical ability required, even though there is going to be the Bridger Mountain Big Band will be joining them. So you can sign up for a free silly instrument making workshop on July 28th or 31st. And to join in the parade, go to their website at randomactsofsilliness.com to learn more about that. They also are celebrating 5 years of fairies. So this is going to be the Bumblewood Thicket, a fairy village at Glen Lake Rotary Park. They have fairy swag from Intrigue in Ink. They have new and improved commemorative book for sale at Country Bookshelf. Saturday nights in the Fairy Grove, they have theater and music. And the Bumblewood Fairy Houses will be lit up until 9 p.m. every night. Be sure to go to their website, which, again, is randomactsofsilliness.com, and get more information there. I think you have to have tickets for the music productions, the theater productions that are there. Oh, yeah, and the dates are August 30th. Through September 22nd. The Bumblewood Thicket will contain all new fairy homes and businesses created by talented local artists, also known as fairy architects. The Bumblewood Thicket Fairy Village is self-guided, free, and open to all during park hours of 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. Well, my thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for their continuing work on Desert Oracle Radio and their willingness to share it with you. Our sounds today came from my yard, from birdnote.org, and from Carl Gray Rock by way of YouTube. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening today. You can leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246, and I would love to hear from you. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Of course, Ken's discussion about Giant Sand got me curious. I've never really heard his music before. So today I am thanking Giant Sand for the song Stranded Pearl to take us out. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams. Reflecting on I lost me my eye in a battle. Went there to rattle their cage. And I lost sight of the big picture. Now this permanent fixture is my rage. Reflecting on